This is a podcast from ABC Local Radio Overnights. I'm Rod Quinn. What would you say if someone asked you what the biggest change has been over your lifetime? Would you be able to answer that question? Our intern, Emily Contador-Kelsall, took to the streets of Australia to find out what the biggest changes have been over the last 50 years and where people think we are heading.
I can remember driving by car from Sydney to Brisbane 50-odd years, 60 years ago, and you wouldn't see anything on the road, and you wouldn't even see service stations. You might see just one bowser, but now you go up and the roads are huge and there's service stations everywhere. Huge change in the world.
The kids have more online friends than real friends. I mean, I'm 48, so the biggest changes have really been in the areas of technology. And I remember being young and getting our first colour TV. It was very exciting. And it had the remote control, I think it had two buttons on it.
It's actually harder to talk to people now. And I guess global warming has become an issue. So everything now, we do things like just over our phone, everything's, you can find everything on the internet. It's just been pretty crazy.
I'm 40 years old myself. I remember growing up, if you wanted to know something, you either had to go to the library or read a book, or you had to talk to your friend in the know. I'm holding my phone here and I'm looking on Facebook and I'm reading the news about, you know, the elections in California, and I'm also sending text messages to my wife. And
I'm from a country town in northwestern Victoria. And our life has changed radically, but it's changed so radically over the last 20 that anything's possible. So we have to wait and see what the next generation's going to do with our town.
I'm 85, so, you know, it's too difficult to learn all that and change all your thinking. You think for what, another 3 or 4 years perhaps? Well, they're doing another 50 years, I don't know, because I won't be here, and I don't want to be here either.
Next 50 years, there's going to be lots more advances in the areas of technology. I think the impact of global warming is really going to come to the fore.
Australia becoming a republic. Yeah, I'm looking forward to that.
Probably, like, more things will be taken over by not necessarily robots, but they'll be automated, which means that a lot of people might not have jobs.
Way that we work and the way we do things are going to change. Now with technology catching up so much, I don't know if we're going to need to go into an office all together or in workplaces together. I think the workplace is going to change and it's going to become mobile, and I think that's going to affect how we buy things and how we think and how we do things, hopefully for the better.
Hopefully for the better. So, what will be happening over the next 50 years, and what's happened over the last 50 years? Think back. Computers used to take up the entire room. 50 years on, and the same computer power fits on a watch strap around your wrist. So what will they look like? What will these computers look like in another 50 years' time? Can you imagine what your life will look like 50 years down the track, if you're still with us? Let's say, in 1966, TV was in black and white. Many cities and towns in Australia didn't even have TV. Radio closed down for the night at about 10 p.m. or midnight. No one could have imagined on-demand TV or streaming every film ever made or being able to listen to just about every radio station in the world on your phone. If somebody told you 50 years ago that one of the most revered world leaders of the 20th century would be a man then in jail in South Africa convicted of terrorism, that's future South African President Nelson Mandela, a black man, they surely would have laughed at you. Would the people of those times have believed that Muhammad Ali would be getting a hero's funeral, or that the US president was a black man? It was inconceivable. 50 years on, Queen Elizabeth is still on the throne. Britain and Australia have both had female prime ministers. But how many will have been in that office in the next 50 years? Will Australia have become a republic by 2066? In 1966, it was crazy to suggest that newspapers would be on the way out. But by 2066, will the people of those times, that year, look back and laugh at the very idea that we used to have yesterday's news printed up the night before and delivered to our homes? In 1966, when Australia switched to decimal currency, we paid for everything in cash or with a cheque. Few of us had credit cards. Did anyone think that by 2016 cheques would be on the way out, and by 2066 cash would probably have gone the same way? In 1966, we drove big cars that were fuelled by unleaded petrol. Oil was plentiful. By 2066, will we drive cars at all? Will the oil have run out? In sport, Melbourne had the VFL, Sydney had the Rugby League, and that was that. In 1966, St George won its 11th straight premiership. St Kilda won its only flag. Cricket was played during the day in white clothes with a red ball. Soccer was a minority sport played by ethnic communities, and the World Cup was a dream still years in the future. An overseas entrant in the Melbourne Cup was a New Zealand horse. We didn't get them from overseas, from the rest of the world, only from New Zealand or Australia. In 1966, most Australians had not been overseas, and if they had, it was probably to England by boat. It took 6 weeks, and now it takes, by plane, just 24 hours. How long will it take in 2066? In 1966, we still had the White Australia policy, but now we're edging towards nearly half of the population being born overseas, or with a parent born overseas. In 1966, we had a young population. Now, our population is rapidly ageing. In 2066, will anyone care that people of the same sex who love each other might want to get married? In 1966, it was still illegal to be gay, and that would remain the case for decades in this country. By 2066, will global warming still be an issue? Will it be too late to do something about it? In 1966, there were fears of a new ice age. We ate white bread and meat with three veg. Fast food was a meat pie at the footy. Most towns had Chinese restaurants, but pork in plum sauce was about as exotic as it got. Each state had its own beer, and of course, your own state's beer was the best. You wouldn't dream of drinking that other stuff. So where do we go from here? What are we going to lose from the present day? What events or laws will we look back on in horror? Have we lost anything from the past that we actually want back? To talk about it this morning, we're joined by Lenore Manderson, Professor of Public Health and Medical Anthropology in the School of Public Health in Johannesburg in South Africa. She's worked at the Australian Academy of Sciences Australia 2050 project and has worked with universities across the world. She is a Distinguished Professor of Public Health and Medical Anthropology at the University of Witwatersrand. Lenore Manderson, a very good morning to you.
Well, good morning to you. Good evening. Well,
good evening to you indeed. What would the typical day of a working Australian look like 50 years ago? What do you think it might look like 50 years from now?
Well, it's interesting. I've just been reflecting, and I've been picking up some of the same points you had and a few more about what it was like in 1966, with the advantage of having been a teenager then and so remembering some of those things. And, you know, the landmarks that you raise, I think, are really relevant ones. And the average Australians in 1966, to start with, lived in nuclear heterosexual families. And women, if they were married, weren't working because it was still illegal for or impossible for women to be employed by the government or as school teachers, which is one of the places they would have had work at that time. The marriage bar was abolished in 1966 along with the White Australia policy. So it was a turning point. But at that stage, which was certainly an era of white bread and nothing much more sophisticated than an electric fridge and a black and white TV.
Can I just point, pick up on that? Mum was at home, probably. But the marriage bar, again, if you told that to people today, they simply would not believe you. That is that when you got married, you had to resign. You could not work. A lot of women were working as nurses or teachers. They could not keep working. It seems incredible. No.
It does, and yet there are a few foresight pages on the web, and of course the web has totally changed how we access information and the speed at which we can do it. But one of these foresighting, and there are these various companies that are involved and contracted to project, noted with pleasure that in 2066. The gender gap would almost have narrowed to parity. That is, we're still only halfway there, which is pretty extraordinary.
That's shocking. It is, but at least people, women...
It is shocking. So some things like the marriage bar got lifted in 1966, and you sort of rather hopefully think, well, that's it, things are now changing. But, it was only in, and it was in the 70s that things began to change a bit more with the women's movement. And, you were playing music and I was thinking of Helen Reddy, but that was a bit later. That was the 1970s. But 50 years on, the battle is far from won. And for most women in the world, it is still a fantasy that they might have equal access to work or equal pay or anything else.
But do you think in 2066, not that you and I will be there, but we'll look back and be as astonished about the fact that women didn't get equal pay in 2016 as we look back and we're astonished about the marriage bar in 1966?
See, the problem is that if this projection is right, women will only be getting parity and we won't be looking back astonished. We'll think, I can't believe it's taken us almost an entire, generation. I mean, I guess I won't be alive then because I'd be well in my hundreds. But plenty of people who've got insomnia and are listening now will be alive. And, it does make you reflect on the way in which some values have moved quickly and technology has changed, but other things have really been limping. And, the other key things that I think, for me, some of the key social things in 66 were, firstly, the lifting of the marriage bar, and secondly, not irrelevant to making that even more meaningful, the contraception was increasingly available. The birth rate wasn't much higher then, so women weren't having big families. They were having three, not two, children, but no more. But also at that time, there was also the end of the White Australia policy, as you pointed out, which was the beginning of a very, very slow move. And that was the year that the government was planning a referendum to count Indigenous Australians in the census. And again, if we can in 2066 be able to say, could you believe how racist and intolerant Australia was, not only in 1966, but in 2016, we will have come a long way. If we're around at all, it would be really nice to imagine that we had made big social gains as well as technological gains.
Okay, let's talk again about the workforce then, though. We're talking about how there are far more women, of course, in the workforce now. But in 50 years' time, will we even be able to recognise a workforce? People have been talking about telecommuting and all the time and working from home as well for a long time. And someone else was saying, well, you look at your office and in, say, 10 years' time, you won't see any of those people because you won't have a permanent workforce the way that we have had in the past, that you get a job and you stay there and you work with the same people for a long time. That really we're looking at a time where there's the greater casualisation of the workforce. What can we even think might be the case in 50 years' time?
Well, I think that we are living at a really significant moment in that respect, because one thing was that we had what was called and what genuinely was full employment in 66. Now, full employment meant 1.6% were unemployed, and I've checked this on several sources. I still don't believe it, but this is what I keep getting, with a mean time of being unemployed being 3 weeks. Wow. Now, of course, women working who are married have changed the number of people looking for jobs. But I do remember that it was a time of full employment and you could get work at any time for all kinds of things. But, you know, you could walk in as a student and walk out with a job. And today we have a phenomena of high levels of unemployment, high youth unemployment, and long-term unemployment, by which we mean years, not more than a month. Now, if there is continuing technological change, as there surely will be, then the question is, how do we engage, how do we all do things that are meaningful when many of the things that we do now we will no longer be needed for? One of the things that I've been fascinated in looking at was self-assembling machines, by which not only jewellery and some other little technologies can be produced by 3D printers, but there will be giant equivalents of 3D printers that will be able to take a template, use nanotechnology and print out things like buildings. And you know, in this imagining of a future, a building could be built in 2-3 weeks with robots testing to ensure that everything is stable and correct, and the printers just printing, starting by printing out the corner posts and then building it up and with some scaffolding, and there you are, you've got an office block or something. That, of course, strips people out of work everywhere, and you know, and as I'm very mindful of, because opposite my apartment in Johannesburg, there are people working 24 hours a day on an apartment block, and they're just all, they're doing basic labouring, they're hand laying bricks and everything else, and the notion that some of these basic things, where people have work, even if it's not the most glorious work, or in countries like Australia, are working doing things like supervision of construction and engineering, that so much of that will be overtaken, then what do humans do?
Yes, what does everybody else
and
do?
How do we do it in ways that provide meaning for our lives? Indeed. And, you know, linked, clearly, the answer is clearly not, we'll have more leisure. And, you know, one of the things that I'm very mindful of in living here some of the time, I live partly here and partly Australia and partly in the US, and unemployment is so high here, and you see so many people who really have nothing to do. Although, you know, a significant number, I think, do work in voluntary capacity and in human services. And that's already happening, of course, that all of us are moving, and that's been part of the factor, even in contemporary unemployment, that the jobs that people had in 1966 have genuinely gone. As a person delivering mail, because there's no longer really a functioning post office. It has a very small role.
Yeah, smaller than it used to, and it's losing a lot of money. So we wonder what's going to happen. I mean, the future isn't always much, much better. In fact, we're losing a lot of things that once worked very, very well, and sadly they don't anymore because of the way that the internet has changed things, and we still can't work out how it's going to be. And look, the internet really has only been around, as we know it, for about 20 years. So what happens with in the next 50 years is going to be remarkable. But Australia, you know, has a relatively low unemployment rate compared with the rest of the world, or some parts of the world. So we have always managed to find jobs for most of the population. I understand there are many parts of the country that have very high population unemployment, especially youth unemployment. But do you think that in the next 50 years we will find new jobs for those people who are going to be put out of jobs by such things as 3D printers?
Well, I mean, and clearly we have to. And, you know, Australia has for a long time been working on the basis of it being a knowledge economy. I think that that's going to change to some extent. But education, healthcare, environment, and so on will necessarily remain part of agenda. And I mean, the real one of the interesting questions I think to reflect on, other than, I mean, there will be a continuing need for those kinds of services that I mentioned. But the other thing is, how will Australia in 50 years be part of a global world, if there is even an Australia as we know it? I mean, what in past we've watched so much changes in political boundaries and fragmentation since 1966, so that a map of the world is no longer makes sense. So you know, to some extent, people will have to become global citizens. And one of the ironies that has to be addressed, I think, is that in 1966 there was, notwithstanding some of the politics, including Vietnam War and so on, a sense of Australia being a country that was growing global citizens. So while we entered the Vietnam War and had LBJ out and everything else, we also were introducing Asian languages in schools and increasingly engaging in Southeast Asia and more broadly. Okay. That no longer, right now, is not the case. And yet for us to have a place, including for our children to have places, you know, we absolutely have to rethink how we're positioned and you know, and that's certainly not going to be as a friend of the US. I mean, it does have to be both regional and then more broadly global. Okay.
Lenore Manderson is our guest, a distinguished professor of public health and medical anthropology at the University of Witwatersrand. In South Africa. And we thank you very much for your time today. One of the things that will happen, surely, is that because of the way that migration works in Australia, that I suppose the white Anglo population will become a minority majority in the country. And that is that already we have 47%, I think, of people either first or second generation Australians. First generation Australians, yes, makes up about 28% of the population. Remarkable figure, yes, more than a quarter. So the, yes, people that used to run the country may not in future. And who knows what this will look like in 50 years' time, whether or not the majority will not be the white Anglos, the English, the Anglo-Celt population from the last 50 years.
Yeah, I would be really surprised, including that, you know, I mean, for the young people, not in 66, the big difference was whether you married out or not, and marrying out meant whether somebody from the Church of England married somebody who was Catholic.
Yeah.
So, and that we've made huge changes, and people, despite people who are less than tolerant about immigrants, and despite policies that really still put an enormous show cause to people who are desperately in need and support, Australia and the rest of the world has to come to terms with the fact that there are large numbers of stateless people in the world, and to think of creative ways to address that problem, not to pretend it's not there or to turn back the boats or whatever. And that's not a uniquely Australian problem, that's a global problem. But at the same time, the more people we have, I mean, I think that Australians are enormously embracing and get great pleasure about from the multiculturalism that really does flow. I mean, the fact that we can walk in any of the major cities in Australia and choose whether we want to eat Ethiopian or North Korean or Mongolian or Uyghur food or whatever is just, you know, something that one should, you know, really, really...
We should be grateful for that.
...remark upon. Well, given that in 1966 it was, sure, meat and three veg.
Exactly, but...
And as you said, you know, yeah, some sauce was made a meal of fancy.
But people always bring up food as the example of the benefits of multiculturalism. But I wonder how many people, yeah, would be happy to walk down their street, as we see quite often, and if a mosque had opened, or if we had... a lot of people from one particular country perhaps living on that street. People are reluctant to embrace that side of multiculturalism, aren't they?
Well, I wonder who they're in the end. Yeah, I mean, we choose food because it's an easy example. But, you know, many of us have sisters-in-laws or cousins and or children, yep, or children-in-law who are from very different backgrounds, and we certainly have friends and children of my own children's generation, you know, in many respects, don't even think it is worthy to explain somebody in terms of the background from where they come. But we take it for granted that we live in a diverse society and embrace it. And I think that that's, you know, increasingly true everywhere in the world. And, and you know, one of the things that we might hope for in 2066, if 2066 is, you know, is a viable, you know, thing to anticipate, is that people really won't think in those categories. I mean, I think right now there is a revival of a lot of anxiety, and that's, you know, certainly clear in the United States and South Africa, but it's also evident in frustration from Indigenous Australians. But I would like to think this is, you know, the last, you know, point at which we have to have these conversations around racism and social exclusion, and that from now on, people are going to make no bigger deal about skin colour or heritage than they are about the sex of their parents.
All right, okay. 1-300-800-222. Let's take some calls. A lot of people wanting to talk about this, and Claire wants to start with one of the issues that dominates discourse now and into the future as well. Claire, good morning.
Good morning. I am very worried about in 50 years' time what is going to happen with climate change, because we're not doing anything. We should be doing something desperately quickly now, and we're not. And in 50, I mean, we're having storms and fires and floods now, but in 50 years' time, if we haven't made huge improvements to the situation, it's going to be terrible for... I mean, I'll be well dead, but...
So will I, Claire.
For everyone, for all those living.
Okay.
I mean, the heat and the fact that whole different types of produce will have to be changed.
Yes,
you know,
it will change so much, Claire. Yes. Thank you so much about that. Lenore Manderson is our guest in South Africa. So, climate change. Some are addressing it. Some are ignoring it. By 2066. I mean, people are already saying it's too late, but what about in 50 years' time?
In 50 years' time, if we haven't addressed it, then we're really looking down the barrel of a gun. I would have said the best scenario will be certainly that in... I mean, the figures that I've seen suggest that extinction of tropical forests and extinction of particular varieties of plants and animals will peak around 2066. And the ones that don't, that are still alive then, there will be less extinction because you'll have a few sustainable things.
Right.
But there is clearly a massive problem. I mean, one of the things that I find both wonderful about South Africa is the extent to which people really are talking and doing about wind and solar, and indeed in the US too. And one of the bothering things about current policy in Australia is lack of action. My imagination would be, and it's not really very peculiar, would be that by 2066, the standard roofing would be solar panels.
I would certainly
so you wouldn't
hope
be saying, do I want colour bond or tiles? It's simply, but
it
I also
mandatory.
Would imagine that if we have anything like trains and other kinds of urban and interurban transport, the roofs of all of those would be solar.
I couldn't agree with
you more.
And
the technology is there, and so then it really is around will.
Okay.
And I think that more generally, in relation to Claire's comment, you know, the only way we're going to get change is to continue to repeat a message, but not the least of which is that Australia has really lost its place as a world leader in this domain. And Australia was very strong after 66, but you know, in the 20th century around the environment, and we've lost that leader.
Okay, we've got to move. We've got a lot of people who want to talk to you, Lenore.
Okay.
Tom, good morning.
Thank you.
Good morning, Lenore and Rod. Fantastic and intriguing discussion. You know, you could talk about it all day and night for the next 50 years, but cut a long story short, let's get straight to it. What I find intriguing is, without, you can easily romanticise the past or the future, but what tends to happen is that human nature remains pretty constant. What I'm intrigued is we were told we were all going to be working shorter hours. We've got entrenched long-term unemployment. But at the same time, we've got people under extraordinary pressure to hold their jobs, work longer hours. House prices are horrendous.
Yes.
And the pressure on women in particular, and men, but also with childcare costs. You know, we've never worked harder longer. This is the irony. And at the same time, you know, I'm a recently retired teacher. You know, we're surrounded by technology, but we've got literacy and numeracy rates in real trouble because of the way the kids use the technology. I've noticed one thing that altered in an educational sense was how reading has changed, where we assume they're using technology for deep reading, and they're not. They're using their entertainment and socialising. So I see a lot of kids that are just struggling to get jobs. So there seems to me there is the haves and the have-nots. Even in this lucky country like Australia, there's some incredible innovations. I agree. I suspect the climate change issue will only alter when there's a Republican president who convinces big business that we've finally got to do something. But that could be another 20 years with all the deniers out there.
Okay. Yeah. All right, Tom. Thank you very much for that. A lot of ground Tom covered. Lenore?
Yeah, I'd agree with him. And not only convince big business, but tax them to pay for it.
Okay. And what about housing prices? Young people today can't afford houses. How are they going to do that? Seriously, we're going to have to decentralise, move to more regional areas where they might be able to afford a house. But unfortunately, they can't do that unless the jobs are there.
No, indeed. And it's very hard to imagine how we will de-urbanise it. We were already, 83% of us were urban and 64% in capital cities in 1966. It's now 90% urban. Mm. And I really think that what it has to be is about an increasing changes in both how we pay for housing and what the role of government is in providing housing, but also what housing entails. And, you know, I would much prefer a much denser city with green belts.
With better public transport, otherise it simply won't work. That's the problem.
The denser it is, the more it's going to push better public transport.
I would hope so. Now, Margaret, what a story. What happened to you 50 years ago?
Well, Rod, this is a bit from left field.
No, this is exactly a classic example of how society changes.
50 years ago next week, I was Miss Taxation, entered in the Miss Teenage of Victoria, 1966.
Wow, you're working for the Taxation Department.
I was working for the Taxation Office. And so I was one of 102 young teenage girls who walked down the middle aisle of the Melbourne Town Hall in this teenage quest, dressed in long white dresses and long white gloves. And it was emphasised that this was not a beauty contest. It was a fundraiser, and it happened to be run by 3AW at the time, and it raised money for the Royal Women's Hospital, and it meant that Francis Perry House was built within the next 10 years. But in 50 years, well, now the beauty contests as such are ridiculed, also in 50 years, what would be happening? I don't know.
Margaret, what did you get for winning, by the way?
I won a first-class ticket around the world with my mother.
Wow.
It was a condition that your mother had to come. She had never been past Rosebud. So we went Rome, New York, London, San Francisco, Honolulu and home.
What a fantastic trip. How long did that take, Margaret?
Well, that took 7 weeks, yes. We ran out of our $1,500 prize money in San Francisco, so Mum had to put $500 in to get us through Honolulu and home. And my sister, well, I was one of four children, and my sister was in year 12, and she had to cook the meat and three veg for Dad and the other two while we were away. She wasn't too happy either.
Margaret, look, could you hang on? I want to get your details because I want to hear more about this trip, I think. But Margaret, thank you so much for telling us about that. But I think we'll get Margaret back on the program because I want to hear about that. Talking about beauty contests, I mean, they still go on. They're not quite as widespread in Australia, but still Miss Universe, you can still become a star as Jennifer Hawkins did by winning that, and Miss America still goes on. But what about that trip? We'll definitely hear more about it. But that was, I suppose, an opportunity.
But the interesting thing is going to be that, you know, it may well be that we've kind of peaked in terms of our sense of the world as a playground, and that, you know, if people, you know, that an increasing number of people will make decisions that it's just, you know, not, you know, to pay more if they're going to travel rather than to pay as cheaply as we do now, because it has never been so cheap.
Indeed. And look, as Margaret said, you know, her mother had never been beyond the suburb, that this is when travel really started to become more and more international. Some people never went interstate in 1966. But, you know, when 747 started coming along in the early 70s, that all of a sudden and people began travelling internationally, whether it was the hippie trail across country, across Asia and Europe, but people started doing that, and they just simply didn't do that before that.
And yet that is part, I think, also of both how lucky Australians have been. And, I mean, for me, what's interesting, I mean, lots of people, of course, here in South Africa have never travelled out of their town or overseas. But, I mean, and there's good reason for that, but I had a student in the field with me yesterday from the US, and his parents had never left their state in the US. He was the first member of the family.
Well, we should remember George Bush Jr.
And that's a real pause.
Didn't own a passport when before he became president. Yes.
Yeah.
It's disturbing.
I mean, it's quite incredible. It's fascinating.
Well, if you're in America, you've got everything there. Why do you want to see the rest of the world? Susan, good morning.
Good morning.
I want to talk about being a working mum.
Yeah, I'm a working mum. So my husband actually works part-time looking after the children. We own a couple of retail stores that they're spread across Victoria. I've already left for work. I left about half an hour ago, and I'll probably get home about 7:30 tonight.
Right.
Ida Buttrose was interesting when they were talking to her when she was Australian of the Year, and they said, you were amazing and a pioneer for working women. And she said, yes, but the working day when I was a working woman was 9 till 5, and there was virtually no dinner meetings. There was maybe a fax machine, but basically from 5 o'clock until 9 the next morning, no one bothered you. I went home, cooked for my family and bathed my children. And I thought, yeah, that doesn't happen. But the interesting thing, I think, too, is that in the future we have retail stores that I won't be driving anywhere because everything will be online. Everyone will just have their things delivered. So my life will radically change in the next 50 years. Our stores will look incredibly different. They already do. And that's only going to continue to change. So I'm hoping that maybe we'll all revert back and we'll be home with our children.
And so that you'll be working at home as well as delivering to people or making sure those deliveries take place.
Well, you would hope that transport companies or drones by that stage will probably be delivering everything.
Ooh, let's hope so. Thanks, Susan, and good luck with that business. Yeah,
although I'm not sure that isn't a rather scary vision, because I think that what lots of people do, what shopping did for lots of people, is it resolved the problem of how to interact with other people. And so the notion of being at home and having drones delivering food or whatever it is, and not even ordinary everyday interactions, worries me enormously. I mean, I think that, you know, there is a problem anyway, and that's, you know, one of the biggest costs of increased unemployment, that so many people do not interact with others enough. And it's, you know, had implications in terms of care for people who are elderly and isolated for other reasons.
Can I also ask, we got calls, I'm sorry, we will get to you definitely before the end of the hour, but religion is another one, isn't it? Back in 1966, everyone went to Mass, everyone went to church on Sunday or the synagogue on Saturday or whatever. These days, religion, people attending church is down, the people who profess to be religious is down. New Zealand could be the first Western nation in the world to, I think, dip below 50% if they haven't done that already with people who profess to be religious. But what happens in the next 50 years? Are we going to see the established religions really wither?
Well, some religions haven't, remember. It's only Christian religions in Australia that have been, or that are suffering the most, perhaps, in terms of numbers. And Australia is, in some respects, particularly secular. So there's much higher church attendance, I think, in the US. People are much, I mean, certainly from my own interactions with people, and in other parts of the world, it is a vibrant part of society.
Okay.
And it may well be that Australia is a particularly rational society, and in that respect has found, you know, religion not the answer to their own, you know, need to be, to have sustained social relationships and so on. But, you know, I see a turn away and back towards membership in different civil societies. And again, if you go back to the woman talking about people no longer going to shops and so on, the more that happens, the more people need to seek other ways to connect.
Yes, indeed.
And in poor countries, certainly, churches actually play a very strong role in connecting people.
Okay. Matt is next. G'day, Matt.
G'day, guys. Sorry.
That's all right. We're not supposed to, according to the Australian of the Year. What do you reckon, Matt?
I've got a fabulous idea, mate. And look, two things that you mentioned tonight work well with it, a prediction and a and a premise. The prediction being that we'll work less hours, and the premise being, now don't be alarmed, but that that marriage bar that you talked about, okay? Now, obviously that's a shocking thing to me. I never even heard of that, but I reckon that if in the next 50 years we can introduce something like, once a baby is born, there must be, male or female, one of the parents stay home with it and raise it. I mean, we've got daycare societies now where you can put kids in at 6 to 12 months. Now, it's unfortunate, and it's not usually, I mean, basically a personal choice of people. It's something they must do to continue their life and their lifestyle. But
it's all very well, but how do they afford to buy a house, Matt?
Well, mate, hey, you don't have to buy a house. I'm 36 years old. I've ran my own business for 8 years,
yeah.
And I work after hours. I work overnight. None of my kids, I have three of them, were ever in childcare because I chose to stay at home and raise them. I don't own a house. I still rent, but I've got the best life in the world. I can attend all my kids' sporting activities.
Sure. I've got can a great I ask you seriously, though,
yeah.
After you retire, which I know is a long time in the future now, how are you going to pay your rent?
Mate, I have a plan in place. Now, the kids are just starting to get to school. They're in grades 1, 2, and 3. Okay, so there's plenty of time for me to do that. I'm in small business. So I have that kind of benefit that maybe...
Yeah. Not everyone has that ability, of course, if they're working for somebody else.
But listen, money's not the most important thing in life. It really isn't.
I agree with you.
And look, I just see a big disparity with social networks popping up. This is another issue, but it's sort of aligned with social networks popping up and all that sort of thing, that we're actually going to become dissocial with that disconnectivity of that family environment. And, you know, I'm fully active with helping out at my school. I coach a junior rugby league football team. And from what the parents that I've seen when I was playing junior footy and going to school, they're just not as inclusive and sort of on the side. And I see it going downhill socially, really.
Sure.
I like that humans always work their way out, and that's maybe one way that it could work out. Now, it must not be predominantly the female that stays at home, but male, female, I don't care, but we've got to keep parents raising children for longer.
Okay, Matt, thank you very much. Although one of the things, Lenore Manderson is our guest, is that women would tell you, about the stifling conditions there were maybe in the suburbs when they were staying at home with their kids all day. Now, it's changed a lot now, obviously, and, you know, everyone's got a car, most of the people can get out and visit. But, like, for people in those days, I tell you, they wouldn't want to go back to it necessarily because it meant that they lived this stifled life.
Yeah, I mean, I think it was two ways. It was stifling because women didn't have a choice, and there was no space for them to even imagine themselves doing other things. And, you know, people like me, you know, I came of age in the at second wave feminism, so I wasn't subject to that, but my mother and women of her generation certainly were. And, you know, I lived in Canberra in 66, and people used to talk with insight about, you know, suicides in the suburbs of Canberra, of women at home without people supporting them, without any networks and with no choice. And, you know, that's there in the vision of 1966 and the average woman being 33 and walking the kids to school or waving goodbye to them on the bikes. And, you know, you can't go back to that picket fence. But I think vision of what the world was like. But I think that the key issue that your previous caller picked up is one around choice. And I think
Well, he
that
doesn't want to make choice. People, he wants that people should be forced. One of the parents should, you know, have to stay home to raise the children.
I'm allowing the choice is actually a good thing. So
I agree with you.
I think that, you know, your point is around people, if they want to have a house, having to work. And I think, you know, the kind of pressures on people if they've got a job to do double a workload. I mean, remember when there used to be a 36-hour working week?
Yes.
And now you just collapse with laughter at the idea that people would have that much leisure time rather than, you know, filling it in by, you know, working at night as well in order to be indispensable, in order to be valued. But, you know, I mean, I do think that there's an increasing sense that different people will have would like different choices in how they live their lives, and we as a country probably need to think through how to do that.
Okay, Audrey, I think it's our last caller. Good morning, Audrey.
Good
you
morning.
Wanted to talk about the marriage bar?
Well, I was married in 56,
right,
and I started teaching in 52.
Yeah.
And there were married teachers on the staff.
Right. What kind of school are we talking about, Audrey?
We're talking about New South Wales Public Service.
Okay. All right, yeah.
And there were at least two married pregnant women on the staff who came back after they had their children, immediately after they had their children.
Right, okay.
And also, when you became a teacher, you got a scholarship to become a teacher.
Yes.
You were bonded for 3 years after you finished your training, 5 years if you were a high school teacher. And even if you married, you could not break that bond.
Wow.
You had to continue teaching. So the idea that you couldn't, there was a marriage bar in 1952 was wrong.
Okay. All right, Audrey, thank you very much for that. Lenore?
Oh, well, I guess they introduced it later, but it was certainly there in 66, and there were bonds later, and the whole bonding of labour was, you know, of being bonded to work out your training was actually something that Gough Whitlam dismantled, because people like me too got to university as women by taking on teachers' college scholarships.
Well, if you actually watch the Australian film Wake in Fright, one of the terrible things about it, he is a bonded teacher and he's trying to win the money to get out of his bond so that he can go home from that outback town back to the city. Look, there's so many more things we could have talked about, and I'm so sorry that we didn't get the chance to do that. But health is going to be a huge issue. I mean, obviously the obesity crisis in this country and around the world in Western nations is one that will undoubtedly affect our lives in the next 50
years. But, you know, it's not just Western, because it's here too. And in poor communities, we've got terrible problems of obesity and relating to that diabetes and heart disease. But I couldn't find figures for 2016, but 2014 to 15, oh, it wouldn't be available.
Yep.
The most recent figures, 64% of Australians are overweight or obese. Mm.
That is only going to get worse, I'm afraid to say.
But it's terrifying, isn't it?
Is.
I mean, and when I was reading up on that, that was where the image was of the 33-year-old woman waving goodbye to her kids who are on bicycles and then walking with her string bag to the shop.
Yes, Lenore,
we
are going to have to leave it there, unfortunately. Lenore Manderson, Distinguished Professor of Public Health and Medical Anthropology at the University of Vivatesrand. Sorry, I'm going to say it again. Vivatesrand, I hope.
Fitzwatersrand.
There you go, in South Africa. And I really appreciate your time, Lenore, and I hope we get the chance to talk again.
Thank you so much.
Well, that's another podcast from ABC Local Radio Overnights. I'm Rod Quinn. Thanks for listening.